Okay, welcome to the first episode of a sort of mini series in the podcast, which is going to be a bit of an experiment in me just taking some time to have a think about the different parts of 1984. There's no plan, there's no script, I haven't practiced this. The idea is that this would stand as an example of how I might speak to students, sort of in an impromptu meeting that they might request, and you know, we'd come along and we'd have a chat about the novel. And I hope that this might be of use to not only students but also other scholars working on the novel, or teaching it, or you know, teachers in secondary schools. Who knows? Anybody with an interest in Orwell, I hope, will find something of use here. And the plan is for me to go in hour-long episodes, so there'll only be three of them, through 1984 at a clip, you know, quite speedily, and just thinking about things that I found interesting as I've spent time with the book. I wouldn't say I'm exactly obsessed with 1984, although I do turn my attention to it fairly often. The way I tend to think about it is that I just haven't yet stopped finding it interesting, and I always see new things in it that are valuable to me, and you know, in conversations with other like-minded Orwell enthusiasts, often come up in those sorts of conversations. So there'll be a little bit of personal reflection on the book. There'll be a little bit of sort of pattern hunting. I love finding the patterns in Orwell's work, so themes that he repeats, sort of images that he comes back to again and again. And then I also want to think a little bit about the form of the novel, because as a novel, it's very interesting. There's lots of sort of elements to it that do get discussed, but are often maybe downplayed in more popular accounts of the book. So anyway, let's just dive right into it. It begins with that fantastic opening sentence. It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. You know, this is iconic. It's an opening that many people know. Even if they haven't read the book, maybe they might know it. One of the things to say, I mean, I've already made a mistake. I should have begun with parts. I said part. There's three parts. It is a three-part novel. And this opening sentence establishes the mood and the manner for the first part. Why three parts? Well, a three-part structure is very useful in certain ways. We're accustomed to three-part storytelling through lots of means, although now we might tend to associate it with cinema. So you get a trilogy, you know, the Dark Knight trilogy, or I was about to say the Hunger Games trilogy, but I don't think that's a trilogy anymore, is it? But anyway, three-part storytelling is useful there. We're accustomed to it from music. So classical music has a lot of three-part structure type pieces. And one of the things that's very useful for a storyteller is, if you're using the three-part structure, is you set things up in your first part, you throw a spanner in the works in the second, and then you either resolve them positively or negatively or somewhere in between in the third part. So 1984, let's keep our head there. The first part of the novel, which is, how many chapters is it? You will hear me changing, swapping and churning pages as we go through. I've just got the novel open in front of me. I forget, is it 10? How many chapters in part one? Eight chapters, I think. Yes, eight chapters. So we've got eight chapters in part one. It's quite substantial. You know, in the edition I'm using, it's 107 pages, that part of the book. And the novel overall takes up, you know, roughly 300 pages. So it's a third of the book. And it's that establishing of the world that occurs here. You know, Orwell's world, as told in 1984, is not that far from the world of his time. And he was writing this in the 1940s, and he'd been living through the Blitz, you know, prior to him beginning to write the novel proper. So he lived in a world and in a time that in some ways bears a lot of similarity to the world depicted in 1984. But of course, in so many other ways, it is an imagined place and a sort of prospective future. So Orwell spends time in this part of the book, and particularly in the opening, you know, few chapters, setting up what it is that Winston Smith, his protagonist, is having to deal with. And our first introduction to Winston Smith is in the second sentence of the novel. Winston Smith, his chin nuzzled into his breast in an effort to escape the vile wind, slipped quickly through the glass doors of Victory Mansions, though not quickly enough to prevent a swirl of gritty dust from entering along with him. We've already got a sense of someone under pressure, someone victimized maybe, someone who lives in a harsh environment. You know, he's nuzzling his chin into his breast, into his chest, in an effort to escape a vile wind. So this place is unpleasant. We are already being told this, even though we don't yet know quite how bad it really is. And we will obviously come to know this. He slips quickly through the glass doors of Victory Mansions. We're given quite a bit of information here already. You know, this is just a one part of a sentence. But he slips quickly through the glass doors. Glass? Why is glass important? Well, as we come to know, and as many readers will know already, this is a society of surveillance. It is a society where the citizens are kept under watch. So glass doors make a lot of sense. They need to be glass because they need to be seen through. And they need to be, the citizens need to be observable through them. Victory Mansions, at the moment, if you've read the, if this is the first time that you've read the novel, you won't necessarily know that this is a kind of highly ironic name for a building that's not only falling apart, but that also the novel's concern with the party's obsession on being victorious at sort of no matter the cost, and often the cost is they will rewrite history so as to make themselves appear victorious. We don't know that yet, but as a novelistic technique, as an establishing of an ironic thread that goes through the novel in its entirety, this is very economical storytelling. So this is great, in other words, to put it idiomatically, as an opening. And then the final part of that sentence, though not quickly enough to prevent a swirl of gritty dust from entering along with him. In other words, there's a fly in the ointment. You know, he's escaping from the harshness and vileness of the environment. But even in the attempt to do that and to go into the living space that he has in all its meagerness, still dirt and dust and gritty, bitty irritation follows with him, follows hard on his heels. Now, I'm not going to devote as much attention to the whole of the part one of the novel as I just have to its opening paragraph, because I'd never finish. But I think it's worth dwelling a little bit, as I have, on Orwell's, what I've called his economical storytelling, or his sort of efficiency in conveying information. There's very little fanfare about this, which is, again, a sort of a curious thing in a novel full of fanfares. The bulletins from the party that announce statistics and the progress of the war and, you know, information about Oceania to its citizens, that they come across the telescreens as a kind of fanfare. There's that sort of fanfare in the book at the level of story. But the prose itself, the language through which Orwell tells his story, is restrained, and it's measured, and it conceals a great deal of artifice. There is and by artifice I mean craft, sort of purposeful attention to the patterning and shaping of words and sentences. This is very important to Orwell, and as we'll go through the novel, you will see exactly how. So we learn other things in this opening. We learn very quickly about the smell of the place, the sort of smell of boiled cabbage and old rag mats. We learn in the second paragraph of the book that there's a thing called Hate Week, you know, a sort of ceremonial celebration of hatred of the other, as Oceania demands of its citizens. We're introduced to the idea of Big Brother. Big Brother is watching you, the caption beneath the poster that Winston sees in his hallway says. And then he hears the telescreen talking to him and telling him a list of figures which had something to do with the production of pig iron. So we're told very quickly a great deal. This is, as I say, it's very economical. So shortly, just to go through this opening chapter, we learn about those things. We learn about ingsoc, so English socialism, which is the sort of ruling ideology of Oceania, the new post-revolutionary society in which Winston lives. We learn about very Soviet-sounding things like three-year plans, and that Oceania is in the grip of its ninth 3-year plan, we know that Winston, or anyone in the society, will always be heard by the telescreen, and therefore any conversation that is to remain private must be kept below, and this is a quote from the novel, the level of a very low whisper. So it's very difficult to express oneself freely, in other words, through speech in this world that is firmly opposed not only to speech but also to free speech. We learn about, or we're introduced to, the site of the Ministry of Truth, this enormous sort of building where Winston works, and then very soon after that we're introduced to the other ministries that accompany it, the Ministry of Peace, the Ministry of Love, and the Ministry of Plenty, or as they are known in the sort of novels and the world shorthand, newspeak, mini true, mini pax, mini love, and mini plenty. On the this is on the Ministry of Truth, we are shown the three slogans of the party: war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. These are all incredibly well-known components of the novel. It's sort of iconic gestures to a dystopian future. So shortly after this information is conveyed to us as part of the what I've called the world building, and it's done very simply, it's just sort of mentioning these things, as you might describe anything in the world that seems ordinary. So Orwell is deliberately making out that these things are established by virtue of lack of context. He's just sort of saying, over here is the Ministry of Truth, over there is the Ministry of Peace, over there is the Ministry of Plenty. On the Ministry of Truth, there are these slogans: war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. Why do it in this way? Well, if you start getting into laboured explanations of what they are, then the atypicality, the difference of it comes through too much. So the strangeness of it is signalled too obviously, and therefore some of the realism that Orwell is aiming for falls away. So you don't need to labour the point, in other words, as a storyteller, for a dystopian storyteller, and Orwell knows this. What Winston knows, and that Orwell gives him to know, is that, and this is a wonderful bit in this chapter, I think, he says that there's an expression of quiet optimism that it's advisable to wear when facing the telescreen. In other words, you have to constantly maintain the appearance of someone who is sort of, in a very middling way, satisfied. There's no ups, there's no downs, there's only the middle satisfaction. And that this is a kind of sign to the people watching Winston through the telescreen that everything is okay. The irony, and you come to suspect this as the novel goes on, is that it's not that the citizens are duping those watching them into thinking that they're satisfied. Both observer and observed, both the people behind the telescreen and those being watched by them, know all too well that it's a lie, that it's a performance. So it's less about convincing people of some truth and more about persuading them, those watching people like Winston, that the performance is being maintained. And that's a subtle difference, but it's an important one, because in a way, everybody knows in this world that something is amiss. And those who survive longest are those able best to play that game. Or, and this is the sort of the desired endpoint of Oceanian politics, of Ingsoc, to inhabit that performance, that lie, so thoroughly as to forget that it is a lie and to just act it out as if it were truth and a product of nature. This is, of course, part of Orwell's satire and his concern with a world that is forgetting what it means to be true. True to oneself, true to an external world, true to a political agenda, whatever it might be. What else do we learn? We learn that in Winston's apartment in Victory Mansions, there is a little alcove to the side of the telescreen, which has sort of been overlooked, or may have been left well alone in the knowledge that someone who lives in this apartment might one day inhabit it, and or sort of sit in that alcove and do what Winston then does, which is what? Well, he writes a diary, doesn't he? He opens a diary. He buys a diary, he opens it, he starts to write in it, and he gets it, we're told, from a frowsy little junk shop in a slummy quarter of the town. And he'd been stricken immediately by an overwhelming desire to possess it. It's terrible to have done this, according to the legal position of his context, of the setting, of the world he's in. Although in some ways to put it like that is wrong, and I've just noticed on this page a point that is a very important little detail, but is a sort of thoroughly significant one. There are no illegal acts in Oceania, because there were no longer any laws, as the novel puts it. So there is nothing, one cannot commit an illegal act in Oceania because there are no laws. This is both coming from a sense that Oceania has kind of fully inhabited the world to the extent as to eradicate all difference. And if you have no difference of opinion, then you don't need laws because everybody is supposedly sort of acting in the way that they should be. But also in a more sort of conniving and underhand way to remove laws, but to maintain a very firm sense of what's right and wrong, is to multiply the possibilities through which people can be arrested. You know, if nobody knows what's illegal, then it's for the state to decide what is and is not legal, and therefore to act on it as they see fit. And this is essentially what the novel depicts, you know, in multiple ways. He opens the diary, Winston opens the diary, and he writes in small clumsy letters, April the 4th, 1984. And he sits back because he doesn't know if this is in fact April the 4th, 1984. He's fairly sure that he's 39 years old and therefore that he'd been born in something like 1944 or 1945. But he can't be sure because, as we come to see and as I'll get onto in a second, history and the recording of it has become so blurred and unavailable through records and, you know, the collective memory, that it's very difficult to know how old one is and you know, therefore, what year it is. So Winston sits there. He's thinking about his itchy ulcer on his ankle, his varicose ulcer. He doesn't want to scratch it because it will make it worse and then he'll be unwell. And he writes, after he's written this date, his first diary entry, or at least the first diary entry on this date. And he talks about going to see a war film in presumably a sort of state-sponsored cinema. And he sees what he calls a very good film of a ship full of refugees being bombed somewhere in the Mediterranean. And this is a moment of sort of ethical peril for him, because he refers to it, Winston that is, in his diary, as a good film. And it's unclear, and this is one of the novel's many ambiguities, it's unclear whether he means it's good because he's kind of become deadened to the atrocity that it depicts, or that he's writing good because, despite the fact that having a diary and writing in one is profoundly illegal in the sense that I've just been talking about in Oceania, he may still be under the thought that were it to be detected, there must nevertheless still be some kind of state obedience in his reflections. Who knows? I mean, it's often read in the former way, that he's kind of brutalized and desensitized to the world of Oceanian thinking. And what he depicts is, you know, in that sense, suitably violent. There are refugees in the sea being shot by helicopters and drowning. And the diary entry quickly moves into a sort of stream of angst and anxiety and the sort of perverted enthusiasm for this. He calls it a stream of rubbish, or at least the narrator of the novel refers to it as a stream of rubbish. But he's not so sure, I don't think. Very soon, he has to come out of this reverie, and the reason for this is that he knows that he's sort of due back at work. So he says it was now he realised, because of this other incident, that he had suddenly decided to come home and begin the diary today. So it is his first diary entry. There we go. I'd forgotten that little bit of clarification. And what he's referring to is an event that happened earlier that same day, which is he goes to the 2 Minutes Hate. So we've heard about Hate Week already. He's gone to the 2 Minutes Hate, and he sees a girl he calls the novel calls it a girl, but it'd be more appropriate to call her a woman. She's 27 years old. But the text reads, she was a bold-looking girl of about 27 with thick, dark hair, a freckled face and swift athletic movements. And Winston hates her, hates the sight of her, presumably because he's attracted to her. And this, in his sort of brutalized, desensitized manner, is the best way he can articulate that. He also sees the other main character of the novel. So we know if we've read the book already that that girl, that woman, that 27-year-old woman is Julia, the love interest. So Julia and Winston ultimately have a relationship that ends in tragedy. He then sees O'Brien, who is the, at first we think, maybe Winston's saviour, somebody who Winston can confide in, be taken along by, and perhaps is the route to some kind of some kind of freedom. Of course, this does not turn out to be the case, and we learn with Winston that O'Brien is in fact a member of the inner party of Oceania and is somebody who will be responsible ultimately for torturing him into compliance. But nevertheless, we see him, and I've always loved the way O'Brien is introduced. Because of how Orwell describes it. He says that O'Brien had a trick of resettling his spectacles on his nose, which was curiously disarming in some indefinable way, curiously civilized. A little bit further on, there's a contrast drawn between O'Brien's urbane manner and his prize fighter's physique. Again, think of how economically Orwell is getting across this information, and ultimately how economically he's signaling the ambiguity and the threat that lies within O'Brien's presence. He is civilized, he's urbane, but he's also got a prize fighter's physique. So he's aligned immediately with violence, with aggression, with contest, with beating people into submission. And this is, in a sense, exactly what he turns out to be. He turns out to be a very articulate, very urbane, you know, disturbingly civilized torturer, and Winston feels the full force of this in the final third of the book, part three, which is in a sense just one long torture sequence. So we are introduced to those two characters, the other two protagonists, basically. The 2 minutes hate shows us the daily brutalizing of citizens that Oceania depends on and enacts. And who is this desensitized, brutalized populace shown to hate or invited to hate? Well, it's Emmanuel Goldstein, the enemy of the people, as the novel puts it. He is the source of all, as the novel continues, subsequent crimes against the party, all treacheries, acts of sabotage, heresies, deviations. They sprang directly out of his teaching. Somewhere or other, he was still alive and hatching his conspiracies, perhaps somewhere beyond the sea, under the protection of his foreign paymasters, perhaps even so it was occasionally rumoured, in some hiding place in Oceania itself. He is the ghost of revolt. He is the ghost of rebellion, the unlocatable by design, so designedly unlocatable enemy who is always present yet never found. And this must be the case because he is necessary to the party and party's functioning and to Oceania's working. A society that is intent on stirring up its citizenry into a perpetual state of hatred, as it must do through the 2 minutes hate, needs a perpetually present yet elusive enemy, as somebody at whom that hate can be directed. And Goldstein fulfills this. Of course, one of the things that Orwell is doing here is alerting readers of his time to how he is, you know, drawing on contemporary anti-Semitism to make this point. He is using this idea that he was very familiar with and wrote about at great length of sort of anti-Semitic conspiracy. And so Goldstein is a sort of instantiation, an institutionalization, an example of that. And the novel clearly sort of invests a great deal of narrative energy in it, not to approve it, but to show how ghastly it is, but also how true to much of the working of its time such anti-Semitism is and was. The novel continues. We see the 2 minutes hate and what it does to people, sort of driving them into a climax, an ecstasy of anger. And then everything settles, everything calms. And the reason that it calms is Big Brother's face comes into view on the telescreen that everybody is looking at, and there's a sort of a peace, a rest. But remember, war is peace, so the one is implied in the other. Before he knows it, Winston is writing in the diary, "Down with Big Brother, down with Big Brother, down with Big Brother," and so on. He can't help feeling a twinge of panic at the thought of doing it. There's a knock on his door. There's always a knock on the door. It's fate knocking. There's a kind of Beethovenian idea. It's like the third... The Fifth Symphony by Beethoven. You know, ba-ba-ba-bum, the door goes. And he has to answer it. He carries on wearing this expressionless face. You know, this quiet optimism that he has to adopt at all times. Even though his heart within is thumping like a drum, it says. He goes up, he answers the door. It's Mrs. Parsons, his neighbour, the wife of his neighbour, who is a character, I put it like that, because the character is more developed, Mr. Parsons. She's asking for his help in unblocking a sink. He goes and unblocks it, and there he meets their children, who are members of the Youth League. They're not members of them, are they? They are members of the Spies, and it leads into a thing called the Youth League. So, and what that means is it's a kind of Boy Scout Association, or a Girl Scout and Boy Scout and Girl Scout Association, designed explicitly to help the party and the society of Oceania maintain its power by identifying and then handing over to the authorities traitors in their midst. And that's exactly what they threaten to do. They come in, they see Winston fixing the sink, and they shout, "Thought criminal, you're a traitor. You're a thought criminal. You're a Eurasian spy. I'll shoot you. I'll vaporize you. I'll send you to the salt mines." So for them, it's a game. They believe in what they're doing, but they also treat it as a kind of kid's game. And we as readers know that there is some serious consequence to telling somebody in this society that someone else is a traitor, sort of telling a state agent, for example, that someone else is a traitor, because they'll be killed. The kids do not know this yet. What else happens? We then, in this same paragraph, in the same chapter, we get to a part that does something that the novel more broadly does a great deal, which is it introduces a memory. And not only a memory, but within the memory, a dream sequence. So years ago, how long was it? This is at sort of page 27 in my edition. It's in chapter 2 of 1984, part 1. Years ago, how long was it? 7 years it must be. He had dreamed that he was walking through a pitch dark room, and someone sitting to one side of him had said as he passed, "We shall meet in the place where there is no darkness." This voice he aligns with O'Brien, but he doesn't know what it means. He doesn't know that... he comes to think that it's a sort of gesture of solidarity, that O'Brien is saying, "You and I shall meet in a place of illumination. You and I shall meet somewhere safe and secure where the lights are switched on and understanding will be at hand." What he doesn't realise is that in some ways it's a more literal statement. O'Brien is saying, "We shall meet ultimately in the torture rooms of the Ministry of Love, where the lights are never switched off because they're interrogation chambers." So there's that. We also see, what else do we see? There's a voice from the telescreen, and it announces news from the Malabar front in the war, and you know, some details are given, and then "Oceania, 'tis for thee," the state anthem plays, giving way to lighter music, and Winston sort of leaves and has to think about how he's going to get on with things. He is still thinking about this when we learn that he's finding his pen, he's finding his diary, and this is towards the end of that chapter. He goes back to the table and he dips his pen in the ink and he writes, "To the future or to the past, to a time when thought is free, when men are different from one another and do not live alone, to a time when truth exists and what is done cannot be undone, from the age of uniformity, from the age of solitude, from the age of Big Brother, from the age of Doublethink, greetings." This is a thing that he writes in his diary towards the end of chapter two. And what he's doing is he's saying hello to a future society that he hopes will have learned the lessons, well, either learned the lessons of his time and sort of defeated powers like Ingsoc and the party, or that is still in the grip of it and that needs a sense of alliance and friendship from a past that perhaps is now so far from it that it can seem impossibly distant. So he puts the diary away, and then we're told at the beginning of chapter three that he's dreaming of his mother. And this is, again, another fascinating point in the book because of the imagery that's used. The imagery here is of his mother being in some deep place, sort of beneath him, and his young sister is in her arms. And there's an echo here of a very similar image in the film that Winston sees, the war film where the refugees are shot by a helicopter in the Mediterranean Sea. There's a similar kind of idea here. And again, the image of a sinking ship comes up. So they were down in some subterranean place, the bottom of a well, for instance, or a very deep grave. But it was a place which already far below him was itself moving downwards. They were in the saloon of a sinking ship, looking up at him through the darkening water. So he sees them not as a sort of comforting memory, but as a traumatic memory. So the memory of his mother is one of trauma. The dream shifts into some sort of scenery that he comes to call the Golden Country. The slanting rays of the sun gilded the ground that is made of short, springy turf. And he sees a woman walking towards him, and it's Julia. And she is wearing the clothes that she normally wears, her sort of her overalls, her state-sponsored, sanctioned overalls. But she takes all her clothes off and as a sort of gesture of defiance. And Winston, seeing this in his dream, thinks that it seemed to annihilate a whole culture, a whole system of thought, as though Big Brother and the party and the thought police could all be swept into nothingness by a single splendid movement of the arm. And he says that not only does that gesture belong to an ancient time, so a sort of time when resistance could take shape as that sort of immediate action against the party, but also that he wakes up with the word Shakespeare on his lips. And this is both, I think, I've always thought that this is kind of unintentionally hilarious. You know, who does that? Who would ever wake up like that? And how silly might they feel if they did? But also that it's a sign, I think, at some level of what Orwell wants us to see as value in the world of Oceania. So we know, and we come to know, and we'll see in a moment, the next few chapters sort of evidence this very, very precisely, that the language of the kind Shakespeare wrote and used has been completely eradicated in this society. Evidently, the memory of him has not. Winston can remember Shakespeare at some level, although he may not understand what the word means, but at least it's available to him. So he's in the grip of some what you might call a kind of atavistic or a sort of recurring deep memory of a time before the party, before Oceania, that is spilling out of him despite himself, and that he is embodying, literally embodying protest, because he wakes up with the word Shakespeare on his lips and he doesn't understand why. And we're not told any more detail about why in this part of the novel, or indeed anywhere else in it. We don't know why that happens, but, as in, we don't know why he wakes up in that way, but we know what Orwell is trying to do. He's saying, you know, this is, Winston is, in many ways, both through the way he sees through the party's games, the way he knows that things are wrong, but also that he's a kind of conduit for culture of the sort that Oceania is trying to eradicate, that he is in every way a rebel. We are then shown one of the daily routines that citizens in Oceania are forced to go through, these sort of daily jerks. They have to sort of do like star jumps and sort of exercise where the telescreen commands everybody to stand up and to do all these things all at the same time. But we're not, but it's not only that in this part of the novel. We also know that Winston, while he's doing this, is sort of remembering the past. He can't help but remember the past. We know that Oceania is the name of the broad sort of Anglo-American sphere in which his society lives. But we know now, according to this part of the book, that Airstrip 1 is what used to be England or Britain, as the novel puts it. Though London, he felt fairly certain, had always been called London. So that's there. He then has a memory of the war, and he thinks back to an air raid. This is Winston thinking back. And the memory of it is not so much about the air raid, but about the physical sensations of the people that he was with during the air raid. And his mother is also part of this memory. His mother, in her slow, dreamy way, was following a long way behind them. She was carrying his baby sister, or perhaps it was only a bundle of blankets that she was carrying. He was not certain whether his sister had been born then. So again, this sign of the profound difficulty in locating accurate memories about the past and accurate information. During the raid, people go down into a tube station to avoid being bombed, and Winston remembers seeing an old man wearing a dark suit and a black cloth cap who stinks of gin. And we can sense some echo here of what we're told, something I haven't mentioned, something about Winston near the earlier part of the book, which is that he too presumably will stink of gin because it's one of the very few things that he actually drinks. He's kind of addicted to Oceanian packaged, you know, victory cigarettes and victory gin. How little has changed, in other words, over time, but also how alcoholic the society of Oceania really is. We are then shown some more information about what has happened over time. War has been literally continuous since about that time, since about the time of the air raid. So this is not only a society on a war footing, but a society that exists purely in and for war. And the jerks, the sort of the exercise that Winston has to do every day is in a sense a daily physical reminder of this, you know, that they are puppets being commanded to exercise, and they're like dolls ordered around and activated by the state. So chapter four is where we see for the first time what Winston does for a living, and he rewrites history. And some of this takes in the Ministry of Truth, and some of this takes place in important but in some ways fairly sort of tedious technical things, like Big Brother's speech has been malreported or sort of misreported and has to be rectified. He is also directed to change some information about the chocolate ration so that it seems like any new announcement of how much people are going to get is to seem like an increase, even though it's probably a decrease in the amount of chocolate they get. We are also told, what else are we told here? We're told how Winston does this, which is with a kind of pleasure in the work. He does enjoy this. He does enjoy this work, sort of despite himself. But he knows that it's all a lie as well. So the records department as such is, and the sort of the Ministry of Truth, is a ministry of lies, really. And it's not records, it's invention. It's an invention department. We are shown some of Winston's colleagues in the Ministry of Truth, a mild, ineffectual, dreamy creature named Ampleforth, with very hairy ears and a surprising talent for juggling with rhymes and meters. He's like a little animal who's sort of there working away. And this is just one of many instances in the novel where we see Orwell's, you know, career-long fascination with animal comparison. And this obviously reaches a very, you know, key height in Animal Farm. But it's everywhere present in his writing. He is continually comparing people to animals for various reasons, and often with some quite unfortunate effects. You know, if we want to talk about Orwell's sort of racial insensitivities, and there are good reasons to do that, one of the vectors for it is, or one of the ways that it's detectable, is his use of animal comparison. You know, the proles, for example, a little bit further on in the novel, are referred to as sort of creatures with splayed hooves. And this is, you know, tricky to know precisely where Orwell's allegiances lie. But we know for sure that the party, the inner party, views people as animalistic. O'Brien refers to the proles as animals, and he means it negatively. You know, that they are subhuman, according to how he sees them. One of the key bits of information or sort of activity that we see Winston do in this part of the book is to invent a war hero, Comrade Ogilvy, and he invents him in order to override a previous sort of war hero. It says, the reporting of Big Brother's order for the day in the Times of December 3rd, 1983 is extremely unsatisfactory and makes reference to non-existent persons. Rewrite it in full and submit your draft to higher authority before filing. That is Winston's translation of the order that he receives, which is Times 3/12/83, reporting BB day order, double plus ungood, refs unpersons, rewrite, full wise up sub, anti-filing. So the person to be removed, to be overwritten, is Withers, Comrade Withers. A prominent member of the inner party had been singled out for special mention and awarded a decoration, the Order of Conspicuous Merit, second class. But for some reason, whatever that is, he's fallen into disfavour, Withers, and he has to be replaced. It's not only replaced, it has to be made clear through the records, through the evidence in the newspapers, that there was never ever such a person as Withers. There was only ever Comrade Ogilvy. And this is what Winston does. And the chapter ends with this very striking sentence. Comrade Ogilvy, who had never existed in the present, now existed in the past. And when once the act of forgery was forgotten, he would exist just as authentically and upon the same evidence as Charlemagne or Julius Caesar. So the narrator of the novel, at any rate, is aware of a longer history and is putting Winston's activity into that longer history. The next chapter is a great one. I'm not going to talk about it a great deal because, except to say one thing, because I'm already well over the time that I thought I would be for an hour's conversation. This is the part of the book when we are shown the canteen in the Ministry of Truth, and you know, all the sort of vomit looking like soupy meaty casserole that they all eat day by day, and it's disgusting and horrible. And if you've got any interest, as I really do, in Orwell's tendency to describe slimy, horrible, grimy, dirty things, this is one of the best bits in the book for it. There's so much here of interest, but amidst all that, one of the things that I think is worth just drawing out, it's quite often discussed, but it's worth reiterating, is the person that Winston sees, the man who is introduced as having a strident voice talking remorselessly away. He's a kind of party faithful, and Winston sees him and watches him and is fascinated by what he sees. And what he sees is speech coming out of this man's mouth. He says, whatever it was, this is the narrator sort of reporting Winston's internal registering of this, whatever it was, you could be certain that every word of it was pure orthodoxy, pure Ingsoc. As he watched the eyeless face with the jaw moving rapidly up and down, Winston had a curious feeling that this was not a real human being, but some kind of dummy. It was not the man's brain that was speaking. It was his larynx. The stuff that was coming out of him consisted of words, but it was not speech in the true sense. It was a noise uttered in unconsciousness, like the quacking of a duck. The reason this is important is because it shows you, in a sense, the ideal citizen, the ideal party toy of the system, which is somebody who is absolutely faithful to it despite their own interests. And in a sense, the idea of them having their own interests will have already fallen away. But not only that, that they are willing to speak party orthodoxy, party ideology, in a way that is unthinking. And in being unthinking, to be approved of, you know, that is what is desired. And the word for it, duck speak. To quack like a duck. Applied to an opponent, it is abuse. Applied to someone you agree with, it is praise. You know, the ironies here, they just proliferate. They build up. We've got, you know, as I say, so many things of interest in that chapter, but let's move on. The next chapter, chapter 6, sees Winston writing in his diary again, and he's remembering going to see a woman in a street, and he follows her, and she's, you know, a sex worker, and as the novel has it, consorting with prostitutes was forbidden, of course, but it was one of those rules that you could occasionally nerve yourself to break. So in other words, the kind of sex drives, the sex impulses of people are to be satisfied or allowed to be satisfied in Ingsoc through a kind of illicit sub-trade of sex work. The more official sort of ways of allowing for the sex instinct is through partnering. So Winston has a wife in the basement kitchen. When he's seeing the prostitute, he thinks of Catherine, his wife. Winston was married, had been married at any rate. Probably he still was married, for so far as he knew, his wife was not dead. So marriage is permitted, but marriage in the sense that we might understand it, and in the sort of the ideal version of marriage as a kind of loving partnership. That's not what marriage means here. Marriage is a sort of way of furthering party obedience. You know, two people together serving the state better than one might be able to. And it's not as if love is part of the equation. It's more just a kind of an administrative arrangement. People come together and they exist in partnership for the greater glory of Oceania. You know, for example, making love is not something that these people do. They do their duty to the party. That's what Catherine calls sexual intercourse in pursuit of making a baby, their duty to the party. Winston is disgusted by his memory of going to see the prostitute and having sex with the prostitute. And again, we've got a moment here of ambiguity in terms of a slightly different thing now. This is Orwell's attitude to women. There's very little sense of the interior life and struggles of the prostitute, of the sex worker. Everything is told from Winston's point of view. And for this reason, you know, we might say that Winston is privileging the male, the masculine, and the sort of the male sexual drive, or the male gaze even. And those things are all true. I think those arguments can be made. It's also the case, though, I think, that Winston is ashamed. And shamed of his actions. He regrets it. He's disgusted by it because he regrets it. And he's registering the understanding of himself as a kind of brutalized, insensitive, unsympathetic subject. So I don't think that you can make easy distinctions between these things. I think they're both in play at any one point. Winston continues. We're into chapter 7 now. Winston continues thinking about not only the what he calls the swarming disregarded masses to which someone like the sex worker would belong, but also the broader category or group of the proles, the proletariat, the proletarians, who are the sort of the forgotten outer sector or segment of society and in Oceania. And Winston is, you know, he's interested in them, but also, and curious about them, but also slightly fearful of them. He, at the same time, puts in them, assigns to them, political power. Because he says, and this is a very famous line, right at the beginning of chapter 7 of part 1, "If there is hope," wrote Winston, "it lies in the proles." So Winston cannot imagine a way to overthrow the party, cannot imagine some activity or space or manoeuvre through which the party could be overthrown, except through thinking that the proles somehow, in their collective agency, their collective power, have the ability to do it. And this is one of the areas of the book that has been criticized a great deal by critics, subsequent critics writing after Orwell, who said that, you know, one of the things that they say is that he does not allow himself as a novelist to imagine the interiority of, in a sense, the working class, and as the novel has it anyway. And this is a problem. And I think it is a problem at one level in that the novel does not provide some route out and through and away from Oceania. It's very pessimistic at some level. And very, it can be a bitter pill to swallow, actually. At the same time, one of the reasons why it does not detail the interior consciousness of the proletariat is because the novel is told from Winston's point of view. So he, as the novel's subject and as the novel's most prominent and prioritized figure, does not have that information and therefore cannot deliver it to us. So again, there are two sides to it. Winston, we know that Winston likes to go on walks. So this is chapter 8. He walks several kilometers over pavements at this point, and this is after work, after he's been at work all day, and he's sort of walking home, but taking a sort of a longer walk than he might otherwise to do it. And it's also a very nice early evening. It says the sky was a warmer blue than he had seen it that year, and suddenly the long noisy evening at the centre, the community centre that he's meant to go to, the boring exhausting games, the lectures, the creaking camaraderie oiled by gin had seemed intolerable. So he doesn't want to do that. He wants to sort of, as the novel puts it, lose himself among unknown streets and hardly bothering in which direction he was going. So he does this and he wanders around, and he is suddenly thrown into commotion by the sight of a rocket bomb coming down from the sky and destroying the local part of a street. And one of the things that he sees here is another instance or a sort of item of evidence that shows us how brutalized he is, because he sees a severed hand on the floor. It was a human hand, severed at the wrist. And apart from the bloody stump, the hand was so completely whitened as to resemble a plaster cast. So this is, you know, an awful sight that Winston is kind of unbothered by. He just kicks it away and on he walks. And he goes into a pub, or what used to be called a pub. And he has a conversation with an old man in there. And he is encouraging him to tell him about the past, to tell him about how things used to be. And we're shown here not only, again, how difficult such information is to access, but also how helpless it is to try and find it in the memories of old drunken men in pubs in the proletarian quarter. And we're told this about it: a sense of helplessness took hold of Winston. The old man's memory was nothing but a rubbish heap of details. One could question him all day without getting any real information. The party histories might still be true, after a fashion. They might even be completely true. So Winston is unable to find the kind of certainty that he wants about where he is in life and where history has got to by talking to old men in pubs who might have memory of that time before the party that Winston so clearly values, because they are unreliable witnesses to it. Now, I've only got a few minutes, so the final bit of the first part of the novel is concerned with Winston going to the junk shop where he bought the diary, and seeing in there something of intense value, which is the paperweight with the coral at the centre of it. So the glass paperweight with the coral at the centre of it. And the old man who runs the shop, who we learn is... what's his name? I've forgotten his name. Mr. Charrington. We learn that he can remember, you know, the time when such things used to be made. He says, that's coral, that is. It must have come from the Indian Ocean. They used to kind of embed it in the glass. That wasn't made less than 100 years ago, more by the look of it. So he doesn't remember the moment of its making, but he remembers the sort of the time of its use, or at least he's read enough to know about it. And, you know, that too would also be unwise to sort of flaunt one's reading in non-party dictated literature, whatever that is and however you might find it, because presumably you know, such books, such information has been eradicated. So, you know, if you've got a book, a history book, that is not a sort of state-sponsored thing, then, you know, you've got something in your possession that you shouldn't have. So there are important details in this part of the book about how the risk of the environment in which Winston moves is constructed and assembled and sort of told to us. The key part of information that the novel, this part of the novel concludes with, there's two important things. One is that there is a room upstairs above the junk shop that Winston sees and is tempted into paying the rent for, to sort of make use of by Mr. Charrington. And this is where he and Julia, Winston and Julia, come to exist in a forbidden intimacy. But the other thing here is this rhyme: oranges and lemons, say the bells of St. Clemens. You owe me 3 farthings, say the bells of St. Martin's. This rhyme that comes into the mind of Mr. Charrington is a sort of tantalizing bit of information, a tantalizing window into a past that Winston longs to have but can never access. And he is, you know, thoroughly sort of enticed by all of this, and he wants to exist there. He wants to use this space and to sort of recuperate himself in it. He buys the paperweight, and he leaves, and he walks, and the paperweight is sort of bumping in his pocket, and he sees or thinks about killing Julia. He thinks about killing Julia because he sort of suspects that she's been spying on him and that she knows where he's been and that she might sort of dob him in, essentially. And again, we're told this awful detail about Winston and about his mind and how it works, and how so much of the way he is attracted to Julia takes place, first of all, through violence. He is violently attracted to her. And it's awful. It's a sort of terrible degradation of himself that the state is responsible for. And who ultimately is responsible for that? Well, it's Big Brother, who swims into his mind as he's sort of thinking about these things. And the actual part of the book ends with a very subtle registration of the economy of the novel, meant both in the sense of the literal sense of, you know, finance and paying for things, but also just the sort of the network, the structure of exchange, the way people interact. Winston takes out of his pocket a coin, and he sees the face of Big Brother gazing up at him from the sort of design on it. And he says that the face is heavy, calm, protecting. But what kind of smile was hidden beneath the dark moustache? Like a leaden knell, the words came back at him. War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. So those slogans have been repeated, and they've been repeated again to remind us of them, but also to suggest, I think, that Winston is trapped by them. He cannot circumvent their logic. No matter what he does, no matter where he goes, he will find those paradoxical statements waiting for him, and he won't be able to get around them. And the narrative is doing this. The narrative is setting it up through reiteration, through repetition of it. It's very effective. Okay, that was a whistle-stop tour of part one. I left loads out. There's a lot more there to say, but this is a sort of brief romp through the novel. When I do another one of these, it will be a romp through part two, which is even longer than part one, and therefore I will have to leave even more out. But, you know, I'll seek to say some interesting things. Until then, take care, and we'll come back to this shortly. Bye-bye.